A reading from the book of Exodus. Moses and the Israelites sang this song to Yahweh. I will sing to Yahweh, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea. Yahweh is my strength and my might. He has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will exalt him. Yahweh is a warrior. Yahweh is his name. In your steadfast love, you led the people whom you redeemed. You guided them by your strength to your holy abode. The people heard. They trembled. Pangs seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. Trembling seized the leaders of Moab, and all the inhabitants of Canaan melted away. Terror and dread fell upon them. By the might of your arm, they became still as a stone, until your people, O Yahweh, passed by, until the people whom you acquired passed by. You brought them in and planted them on the mountain of your own possession, the place, Yahweh, that you made your abode, the sanctuary, Yahweh, that your hands have established. Yahweh will reign forever and ever. When the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his chariot drivers went into the sea, Yahweh brought back the waters of the sea upon them, but the Israelites walked through the sea on dry ground. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to John. Then Jesus cried aloud, "Whoever believes in me, believes not in me, but in him who sent me. And whoever sees me, sees him that who sent me. I have come as a light into the world, so that everyone who believes in me should not remain in darkness. I do not judge anyone who hears my words, nor those who keep them, for I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. The one who rejects me and does not receive my word has a judge. On the last day, the word that I have spoken will serve as judge. For I have not spoken on my own, but the Father who sent me, he himself given me the commandment about what to say and what to speak. And I know that his commandment is eternal life. What I speak, therefore, I speak just as the Father has told me." The Gospel of Christ.
Now, whether you were here last week or just caught the sermon on the video, you might recall that last week's sermon might have felt like a bit of a bombshell being dropped in the middle of everything. Because, of course, I had described that the story of the Exodus that we find in the scriptures really has no archaeological or historical evidence to say that it actually happened the way the scriptures say it. And when you say something like that, it tends to cause a little bit of consternation and puzzlement. But then we talked about just a couple of things, one of them being that the scriptures say 600,000 men plus women and children left Egypt, which would make it about 2 million people. And if 2 million slaves left Egypt, leaving it in a shambles, and then wander in the wilderness for 40 years in an area of 60,000 square kilometers, they would leave evidence that they were there, and there is none whatsoever. And so the question comes, what are we doing with this? What's the point? How do we handle the scriptures then? And we drew attention to the fact that we have to focus on the purpose of why this was written. And so the sermon title ended up being called The Exodus, Fact, Fiction, and Function. And today is going to be part two, if you will, because there is more to say about this particular topic than what we did last week. So what I want to lead off with is to make sure that we understand that when I had articulated last week that the story of the Exodus, and for that matter, the story of the conquest in the book of Joshua, was composed in order to create a backstory, a national identity, a national narrative, as it were, for the people of Israel. When I said that that's what was happening, I didn't want you to think at the same time that this whole story just came completely out of nowhere, as if they just totally made it up out of nothing. If that was the case, one would have to wonder about it anyway. I mean, if you have the opportunity to have a clean sheet of paper to write your own origin story, why would you say that you were enslaved for 400 years if you have the freedom just to make it up from nothing? It wouldn't make sense to do that. And so what I'm saying to you this morning is the story that we have in the scriptures for the Exodus, for the conquest, is based on things that are historically verifiable, that are indeed archaeologically supported as well. But before we get there, let's just talk first of all again of what kind of literature we're talking about here. I used the word myth last week, and I very quickly said we must understand that myth is not simply a fake story or give it some kind of negative spin like that. But we have had the tendency to do that. And part of the reason why is because when we have our book that is so important to our faith, and it's the one we read every Sunday and the one many of us may read every day on our own, nobody believes something because they think it's wrong, right? We take seriously this book because it's important to us, and so we like it, and we would expect it to be saying something true, and we wouldn't be thinking at all that somehow it is erroneous. But then if someone said, oh, that's interesting, you're a Christian, you read the Bible. Well, have you ever considered those who follow Hinduism read a scripture of their own? It's called the Bhagavad Gita. And it talks about all these different gods and goddesses that are part of Hinduism. And our knee-jerk reaction would be to say, oh, yeah, but that's just all myth. Like the Hindus just believe myth, right? We have the Bible, we believe the truth. Which is a very natural thing to do. This is the book we prefer and not that one. But by doing that, we cast the word myth and make it into a negative thing. It's fake. It's not real. It's pretend. It's made up. And that's what they're doing. But we know there's only one true God, that there isn't thousands of gods like they believe. And so we end up creating this false dichotomy about what is myth and what is real. The reality is, myth is not simply a made-up story. It is a narrative that is used to contain a very significant truth or observation or practice or mindset that you want to communicate to somebody else. And we use myths all the time. They have been part of human history from the beginning. And even today, now we have some short humans in the room, so I want to say this carefully, but in a couple of months, we are going to be more than happy to embrace a mythical individual who wears red and white. And we like this mythical individual because we don't believe that this person actually exists. But, you know, the idea of the eight little animals that he has that kind of transport him around, like, this is fun. And it can be used as a little lesson for young ones because, you know, you want to be good because of this person that's coming. And we like the idea of the celebration and the joy that it brings and the idea of being jolly and merry and all of these things that go with it and the decorations that come. And, of course, as Christians, too, we make sure that our part of this story is there as well, but we have no problem with this mythical being around this time of year. It provides a collective practice, something we get to share and enjoy together. It's no problem. The key is togetherness, family, joy, gift-giving, sharing, fun, like all of these things, right? That's just one example of myths that we use. So myths are part of the human endeavor. And to suggest that the Bible has myth in it is not to say that that is now negative, that somehow that is bad, that somehow it ought not to be. There are parts of the Bible that are mythical. There are parts of the Bible that are much more historical. The idea is understanding which and why and what to do with it. So when it comes to this idea of communicating truths in a powerful package known as a mythical narrative, we tend to do that a couple of different ways. One of the ways that we do this is to begin with the idea that we want to get across, and so we have the story in mind that we want to use to communicate that lesson, and in order to make it more plausible and more believable and more concrete, we then attach something historical to it. So what that means is we often historicize myth to get the point across. So an example of this is a couple of weeks ago I said to you that my wife and I are big fans of the television series from the 2000s called The West Wing, which is all about this mythical presidency, President Bartlet, two-term president, Democrat, and the idea is what would it be like if the United States government was run by this kind of group of people who are dedicated to service and this kind of president and these kind of policies. The entire story didn't happen. But it is grounded in reality by saying that it happened at the White House. That 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue had this particular character in it and these people doing the work. And they involve the real-life machinations of the political machine that is the American government and the possibility of even engaging with, you know, China and other countries. They do invent some countries for some of the more sensitive stuff, right? But there are real countries involved in this story, too. That is an example of historicized myth. And it is so well historicized, one might wonder this. What would happen if, let's say, 1,000 years from now, let's say there was a nuclear disaster on the Earth or whatever, and so we're coming out of, you know, the nuclear fallout and everything, and whatever future humans there are 1,000 years from now, maybe they came across these VHS tapes. Okay, DVDs. They came across these DVDs, and it says, oh, the West Wing. I've heard West Wing. I think that's related to the government of the country that was once known as America. I wonder if these could be documentation about what they did. And so they somehow find a DVD player, and they put the DVD in it, and they start watching the show. How many of them might think, did this really happen? I mean, look, it refers to Washington, D.C. That's a real place. It refers to the Congress and the Capitol building. There's even scenes where they are in other countries in the world. This is obviously historical because these are all real places in this story. But of course, we know that it wasn't true. But because the myth of the story that is the West Wing was historicized, it can come across as looking like it really, really happened. Any of you familiar with the movie Galaxy Quest? Same thing happens with the aliens in there. Anyway, if you know the movie, you get what I mean. If you don't know the movie, I'll tell you later. So anyhow, that is one way that we work with myths. We historicize myths to make them more concrete and more believable. And it's not that anyone's trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes, but it's to make it more vivid and more real. The other way that we do this is to take elements of history that have already happened, and then we mythicize the history. We embellish the history. We take these historical pieces and make more of them in order to create the myth that we have, the point that we want to make. And this is what I would suggest to you has happened with the story of the Exodus and the conquest. There are elements of history that are historically verifiable that have been mythicized, that have been amplified in order to make the point. So what are these historical elements? Well, here are things that we know happened. There is archaeological evidence for this. The first is Egypt had slaves. Egypt had slaves from the south of Africa and also from the Middle East, from what are known as Semitic peoples. Now, today, if we talk about someone being anti-Semitic, we mean that they're anti-Jewish, okay? But back then, the Semitic peoples were not simply one kind of people. So the descendants of Israel were one of the Semitic peoples. They weren't all of the Semitic peoples. They were one of them. And so in that entire region, Egypt had slaves from the Semitic peoples. That did actually happen. And many of those slaves did get to go back home to where they came from. That did happen. Another fascinating thing that was discovered is that there was a group of people in the 1500 to 1600s BCE for about a 100-year period of time that had come from the Levantine coast. So this is up where Lebanon is now. So they were Semitic peoples that had made their way into Egypt. And for about 100 years, they gained such influence and power that they were actually able to give leadership to Egypt. These foreigners led Egypt for a time, which is a lot like what the end of Genesis says when Joseph, the son of Israel, went to Egypt and became number two to the Pharaoh and instructed Egypt on how they were to manage 7 years of famine. These people were called the Hyksos, and in the first century CE, Josephus tried to say that the Israelites and the Hyksos were the same. However, that has since been proven to be false. We can see why he'd kind of want to make that the case, but he made a conclusion that unfortunately was not true. So there is an instance of foreigners coming to Egypt, rising to power within Egypt, kind of like the story of Joseph. And then ultimately those people were expelled from Egypt. They were forced out. And of course, that's kind of how it goes once the 10th plague has happened and Pharaoh's finally had it up to here with the Israelites. Go, go, get out of here, go away. You know, and so you kind of get that having happened at some point in Egypt as well. The conquest itself, one thing we do know is that Israel became a kingdom and dominated Canaan by 1000 BCE. That happened. We know that. What we have no support for is the idea that they did it the way it's described in the book of Joshua, that they, as a great army, went through from south to north, taking out one city after another. It didn't happen that way. We do know that Israel existed because the Merneptah stela that I talked about last week, this clay tablet that brags about what Pharaoh Merneptah accomplished in Canaan, one of the things he said after naming this people and this people and this people that he defeated, he names Israel. And so that's the earliest evidence we have for the name of Israel. In the first decade of the 1200s BCE, we know that Israel existed. But now the Merneptah stela says that this Pharaoh defeated Israel and his seed is no more. Well, obviously that was an exaggeration because 200 years later, Israel has taken over the entirety of Canaan. These are all the historical elements that really happened, but not at all to the extent that we see in the Bible. So in telling their backstory, once Israel had established itself as a kingdom, and they're wanting to say, here's what our narrative is, here's who we are, here's who our God is, and here's how we're going to respond to our God, they built that story, they crafted that story, they created that myth on the basis of these historical, believable elements so that they could say this and encourage the readers to walk forward in this idea of who they are and who their God is. That is what I'd suggest to you is what has taken place. Now, there's another factor that helps undergird this idea. And this is to say the first seven books of the Bible, so the five books of the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and then Joshua, which is a story of the conquest, and then Judges, which is the 400-year period where the 12 tribes of Israel are kind of working together before they eventually coalesce into the single kingdom in 1000 BCE. These first seven books of the Bible are noteworthy because they have many, many, many instances of hugely visible, public, dramatic, supernatural occurrences. Whether we're talking things like a worldwide flood, or the Tower of Babel and God confusing all the languages, or whether we're talking about the 10 plagues over Egypt, or whether we're talking about the parting of the Sea of Reeds that they can walk by on dry ground when the Egyptians get stuck in muddy ground, whether we're talking about the pillar of cloud that led the Israelites by day and the pillar of fire that led the Israelites by night, whether we're talking about a man who had rebelled against the leadership and when he was called on the carpet for it, his family and his household was brought in front of all Israel, and when judgment was pronounced that they violated what God was saying, the earth opened up and swallowed them all and closed back up of them as once again as an instance of divine judgment. When the people of Israel walk around Jericho and shout and the walls come a-tumbling down, this is not how it normally works. These kinds of dramatic, visible, supernatural events are all over the place in the first seven books of the Bible. But once you get to 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, where the more historically verifiable evidence is, you suddenly find that happening a lot less frequently. There are moments where we see that. The prophet Elijah, after the days of Saul, David, and Solomon, and the kingdom has split into two, and King Ahab is leading Israel in a bad way, Elijah has this showdown on Mount Carmel with the 450 prophets of Baal, and God answers with fire from heaven and consumes the sacrifice. That story is on that side, but you don't see a lot of them. When there is something pretty dramatic that takes place during this period of time, it is in the context of the prophets. It is the prophets who do the miracles. It is prophets who see these amazing supernatural things. But even that changes somewhat. The prophets are indeed the ones who have conversation with God, but whereas in the first seven books of the Bible, you know, Abraham talks to Yahweh directly, Yahweh appears to Abraham as three men, and he has a conversation with them. Moses talks to Yahweh directly from a bush that looks like it's burning but is not consumed, and he literally hears the voice of Yahweh. And then he hears the voice of Yahweh on Mount Sinai, and then when he goes into the tent of meeting in the middle of the tabernacle, Moses goes in to speak with God, it is said, face to face. And when he comes out, his face is so shiny that people can't look on it, so he has to wear a veil over his face. But when you get to King David, David doesn't talk with Yahweh ever. He doesn't. When he hears from Yahweh, it's because the prophet, maybe Samuel himself or Nathan, has heard from Yahweh. And when the prophets hear from God, it tends to be more because of a vision or a dream. There are some instances where they hear the voice of God directly. This happens with Samuel when he's a young boy. He hears Yahweh calling him, right? But otherwise, it tends to be in a vision or a dream. For David, he hears from God because of what the prophets tell him. Now, if you read the story of David, you will encounter where it says that David inquired of the Lord. David inquired of Yahweh, and he asked, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Shall I attack them?" And then this text will say, "And the Lord responded, 'Yes, go up against the Philistines, for I will surely deliver them into your hand.'" Well, that sounds like a dialogue. Except that whenever you encounter that phrase that the king inquired of the Lord, what's actually happening there is the king is going to the high priest, who's going to make use of something called the Urim and the Thummim. These are described in the Torah, but the Urim and the Thummim were two devices, kind of like two dice-ish things, that would be held in the high priest's ceremonial breastplate. And the idea was that if the king wanted to ask a question of Yahweh to understand what the will of the Lord was, he would go to the high priest, and they would use the Urim and Thummim to find out. So what David would do is he would go to the high priest and say, "I have a question for Yahweh." And the priest says, "All right." He pulls out the Urim and the Thummim. "What is your question?" And King David would say, "Shall I go up against the Philistines and attack them? And will I have victory?" And then the priest would then cast these lots, throw them down on the ground or on a table or whatever, and depending on how he interprets how they landed, he would say, "The answer is yes." And of course, the writer would then say, "Yes, you shall surely go up against the Philistines and defeat them, for my hand is with you." That's just a really fancy and elaborate way of saying yes. That is what inquiring of Yahweh is, anytime the kings do that throughout that period of history. It is something that today, depending how hardcore you are, might think that's more like divinization and sorcery or something than, you know, let's roll the dice and interpret. That's like reading tea leaves or something. But that was how the will of Yahweh was determined. So it is an interesting observation that in this part of the Bible that I'm suggesting is more mythical in nature is also the one that has the most amazing supernatural events taking place. And the portion of the Hebrew Bible that has far more historical support is the one where that kind of level of supernatural stuff is indicated far less frequently. Just something to consider. One other piece to say on this. The passage that I'm going to cut that out of the video. I have to figure out what's going on with that. Anyways, okay. Yeah, supernatural. Yeah. See, that's what happens. That's how a myth forms right there. Yeah, it means that the microphone is loose. That is the message. Anyway. But this passage that you heard Kathy read from Exodus is Exodus chapter 15. And it is said to be the song that Moses and Israel sing after they have just crossed the Sea of Reeds and God has closed the water over the Egyptian armies defeating them. And it starts off by saying, "I will sing to Yahweh, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea." So it's very clear that's the occasion for what they are singing. And then the song goes on, but then towards the end, it says this, "In your steadfast love you led the people whom you redeemed. Pangs seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. Trembling seized the leaders of Moab. All the inhabitants of Canaan melted away. terror and dread fell upon them. This doesn't happen until 40 years later, because they don't go into the promised land to defeat the Philistines and the Edomites and the Moabites and the Canaanites until after they've spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness. But at the very end of this song, it says, when the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his chariot drivers went into the sea, Yahweh brought back the waters of the sea upon them, but the Israelites walked through the sea on dry ground. How is it that they are singing about the conquest of Israel when it hasn't even begun, and it won't begin for 40 years, according to the story? And then the very end of the hymn, of the song says this, you brought them in and planted them on the mountain of your own possession, the place, O Yahweh, that you made your abode, the sanctuary, O Yahweh, that your hands have established. That is talking about Mount Zion, on which Jerusalem is located, and where the Temple of Solomon is built, the place that would be the abode of Yahweh. This doesn't happen for 500 years, according to the biblical timeline. And yet here the Israelites are singing that it had happened. Well, like we've seen elsewhere, what's going on is because this is being written well after these events, what the writers are doing in creating the story for Israel is they're saying, so here, at the time of the crossing of the Sea of Reeds, we have them celebrating God's deliverance, and God's deliverance includes the fact that he's going to give them the land that he told Abraham way back in Genesis chapter 12. And that's why we have this land. And look, they're even singing about the temple of Yahweh, which you can see right there because Solomon built it. Look, it goes all the way back to that. That's the intent of the writers. But there's no way Moses and the Israelites could sing that song the moment after they crossed the Sea of Reeds. Someone might say, well, they're singing prophetically. Okay, I get that. You could say that. After all, God can do anything. But is that likely? Is that really what's going on? Or does it make more sense that they're crafting this national myth? We do exactly the same thing today. What does it mean to be Canadian? What is our national myth? Well, we're the friendly nation. We're the ones that truly is open to everybody else in the world. We're the ones who invented peacekeeping. And we are not like America. That's a key part of our identity. We are not America. It's like saying we're non-dairy creamer. It's not exactly definitive, but you know, we make it really, really clear. We're not America. We are Canadians. Canadians are different. We are helpful, helping the world by inviting people to come in and immigrate to Canada. And when they immigrate to Canada and they want to become Canadian citizens, there's two things we tell them. Hey, you can still wear the garb of your original nation. You can still speak the language of your original nation. You can still do cultural practices that are important to you. And we can set up cultural centers that allow you to do that in various places in these cities. But if you want to become a citizen, we have to teach you what Canadian history is, and we have to teach you what Canadian values are. And Canadian values do not simply emerge organically from our history. They are the story that we have developed along with our history, that we have embraced to begin to tell people this is what it means to be Canadian. It is our national myth. And every country has its national myth. For the states, it's something called manifest destiny. For other nations, they have their story. And what's interesting is when you talk about astronauts that go up into the International Space Station and they look at the Earth and they see it without its political borders, then they create a new myth. Can you imagine? Maybe John Lennon did it first. Can you imagine if we could see the world the way I can see it right now, where there are no borders, where people are simply people, we are just one people, one group. We aren't divided up arbitrarily because we put a line over here. Jeff and I were talking about how insane it is that Point Roberts in the Vancouver area is this little couple of acres worth of land that's technically the U.S., but you gotta go into B.C. to go anywhere else in the U.S. It's really weird. Like, why? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Wouldn't it be better if we could just see ourselves as one united people? And that is a myth worth investing in for sure. But it's difficult because we all have our national myths that keep us apart. Myths are incredibly powerful. and they speak truth. When we talk about Canadian values, we're talking about the truth of how our country operates, or how we aspire to operate, how it is we are going to say we are not going to be like the U.S. in this thing or whatever. We are not going to be like Russia in this thing over here. We are going to do it this way instead, because that's what Canadians do. That's who Canadians are. And the first seven books of the Bible are saying, this is what Israelites are. This is who Israel is. This is the God we worship and how we respond to that God. That is the function for these books. The fact and fiction piece is less important than the function that they have. I've talked a long time. Let me close with this one thought. What do we do with this, right? Because we're Christians. This actually isn't our backstory. It's not really our history. It does form the backstory for Jesus. It sets us up for what ultimately is the case. We follow Jesus, and Jesus is one who was informed by this story. But we already recognize that we don't have to take this 100%. We already don't. We throw away half the Torah already. We have not created cities of refuge. We do not make sure that women undergo 33 days of purification after giving birth to a boy, or 66 days of purification after giving birth to a girl. We do not maintain the dietary laws that the Torah clearly says, because we understand all of that was for them. We are not them. We are in a different place. So to say that we must take every one of these things as absolutely essential is wrong. Instead, what we do is we look, what is the truth behind the purification laws? What was everybody driving at by talking about these dietary restrictions? And we end up taking these things, whether they were absolutely 100% historical or not, and we make them metaphors anyhow. The collect prayer we opened with does exactly this. This is how I opened in prayer. I said these words: God of love, you brought your people out of slavery with a mighty hand. That one sentence encapsulates the entire story of the Exodus, right? 10 plagues, crossing of the Sea of Reeds, the whole nine yards, even the conquest, but out of slavery in particular, the story of the Exodus, all in that one sentence. You brought your people out of slavery with a mighty hand. So now where did I go next with this prayer? Deliver us from our captivity to self-interest and our indifference to the gifts of others, so that we may be ready to love as you have loved us. There's nothing in the Exodus story about self-interest, indifference, and love for others, apart from the commands on Mount Sinai. That wasn't what the story of the Exodus was about. But taking the story of the Exodus, we've instead made an appeal in our prayer, you know what? Living in a self-interested way, living in a selfish way all the time, isn't what Jesus would want us to do. But so often we find ourselves held captive, as it were, to our propensity to be selfish. So we want to ask God to help us to be more other-centered, to be less selfish. And so we use a colorful term to say, free us from our captivity to self-interest, using the image of slavery in Egypt as a way of imagining how we feel about our self-interest. And then we go on to say, we don't want to be indifferent, and we want to be people who love others, right? Whether this actually happened this way or not has zero impact on what it is that that prayer is actually trying to say. We are using this as a springboard, as an image, as a place to go as to how we might express to God, look, we really want to follow Jesus the way we're supposed to, and self-interest isn't going to cut it. Free us from our captivity. We use this metaphorically all the time. And so the Bible does not need to be cast off because it's mythical or it didn't really happen that way. We have to understand its function. And if we treat the Bible for what it is, rather than try to make it into something that it isn't, we can save a lot of effort trying to argue to make it something it isn't and just get on with making use of the treasure that it is and the powerful imagery and narrative it provides for us, so that we can move forward as we endeavor to follow Jesus For him, this was his backstory, and he has given us instruction that we can follow day by day, even now 2,000 years since he has been on the earth. This is our goal. Let us take our scriptures for what they are and for the purpose for which they were written and make use of them well, that we might follow better in his steps. That's the intent. Amen.